Good to go.
Are we?
Are we?
Yes, we are.
Is that the truth?
No.
Sorry, folks.
We are properly recording.
Okay. Shall we go then?
Yeah.
You're finally listening to Thinkative.
Sorry about that.
The podcast for philosophers, seekers, and the generally curious. I'm Tim Newton.
And I'm Matt Parker.
And this is Jason Reed.
Hello!
Who's usually an excellent engineer.
Yeah.
I haven't even had a drink.
Yeah. And we're all here tonight, or are we?
Or are we?
To talk about truth. And all its variants, which ranges from truth right the way through to big fat lies, I suppose.
But let's not forget to mention our fabulous camera operator, Gav.
Gav.
And, Gavin, yeah.
And Sia's with us again tonight.
Dog of truth.
She must be a lot bigger than she was last time she was on camera.
Yeah.
Is it the same dog?
Yes.
We should have snuck in another dog.
Oh, I should say, if you're watching, because we are, you know, I'll be monitoring Facebook, so if you've got any questions about the truth.
Right,
or comments, or rants.
Yeah.
Please.
Keep it, you know, interactive. Yes, indeed.
We're dying to know the truth, because apparently it is out there, as far as we know. Or is it? But before we even get down to that, here we go, important part of the night. The wine.
The wine.
This week's wine is Viñedos Barijuelo.
Oh!
Yeah, that's from Sainsbury's, that is. It's
Does
a Rioja.
Does it say Sainsbury's on it?
No, it doesn't, no. But it's a Rioja
Crianza,
a Spanish one. And we're going to open it with the rabbit, which has never been seen before. And now must be seen, only heard. This has only been heard before, the rabbit. But, please, Matt.
Let me do the honest here.
Yeah.
If you've never seen this kind of corkscrew before, it's so super easy.
Yeah, look at that. Nobody believed me when I told them. And now,
There you go.
There you go, silent.
It's got a portable version of that.
No, but it comes with a strap. Your glass, sir.
Oh, my glass. Oh, thank you. Only too happy. Yeah, that's great.
Okay, little wine, Jace?
Oh, why not?
Why not?
Here we go. Can you reach it?
Jason is not driving home tonight.
No.
So, everything's fine.
That's the truth, officer.
That is the truth.
He hasn't been drinking on.
Okay.
Well, as they say...
Oh, sorry. You know what? We need that cork, I'm sorry to say. She loves to chew up
not
cork.
That we're going to be putting it back in the bottle, of course.
Right, we're
going to
get some philosophy here in a sec.
Yeah.
Well, all right. I'll just put the wine someplace safe then.
So... Where's he gone? He's off.
Right.
She's off. She's off.
I know. I have a hard time remembering that she's...
Yeah. I was just saying, it's like Sid Charisse, you know. You would, you know. It's the kind of bloke's name, but Sid was definitely a woman, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know who that is.
Sid Charisse, wonderful leggy dancer. Anyway. Here's to Sid Charisse.
Sid Charisse.
That's the truth.
And truth.
To Sid Charisse.
Right.
Right, yeah. Now, where were we?
So, I just thought that... truth, and we talked about this last time, is a topic that's kind of on everyone's mind.
Yeah.
What's up, Jace?
It's disturbing.
It's disturbing.
Yes.
There's this idea of post-truth and alternative facts and all this stuff going around. So I thought it'd be good to talk about sort of the standard philosophical theories about what truth is.
Yes.
And then we can get into a little bit about this whole idea of post-truth and so on.
Mm.
And maybe even talk a little bit about plain old bullshit. As distinct from...
Something I'm well-versed in.
Hey, you know, we're experts now
after
over a year doing this show.
You'd have to be. So tell us. I want to know. I want to know about the philosophical, roots of truth, really.
Okay, so...
Or definitions thereof.
So Aristotle made a very famous statement of what truth is, and I think you're going to find this terribly enlightening, right?
Mm.
He says, to say of what is that it is not, or of what is not that it is false.
Yes.
While to say of what is, that it is, and of what is not, that it is not, is true.
Yeah, which is a bit like saying, you know, red is red and blue is blue.
And blue is blue. So that's it. There you go. Show's over.
Oh, well, we've I'm glad we sorted that one out.
The drink. Top is up. Yeah.
Well, really, yeah. I mean, that was probably, I mean, a useful quote, but actually pretty much, you know, just going to say what is true. To say what's not is not is right. Yeah, but basically that doesn't get us very far.
Doesn't get us very far. But I think there's one thing, there is some content in that. There's a little bit at least, right? Okay. So one thing that comes out of that is from Aristotle's point of view, truth is a property of what we say, right? So this is one of the things that philosophers talk about with regard to what truth is. The question is, what are the bearers of truth? What things are true or false? Is it people? Is it words? Is it something more abstract called a proposition?
Okay.
Is it beliefs? Ideas? What? Mm. So there have been lots of different views about this.
Yeah.
So one view is that it's your beliefs that are true or false, right? And that your beliefs correspond in some way to how things are in the real world, or they don't.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
So, and the way I've put that, so that's, I've said two things there. One is that the bearers of truth on one view, and this is sort of the view that Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore had back around, you know, 1900 in Cambridge, right?
Right.
So the view is that that we have these beliefs about how the world is, and either they match up with how the world is or they don't.
Yeah.
Right?
But the beliefs are true.
Right.
Whatever you happen to believe, that's true.
Oh, no.
Oh, right.
The beliefs are only true if they match up with how things are in the world.
Ah.
Right? But it's beliefs that are true or false. Things about the world just are always true, right?
I see. So, but how can you be sure of the unshakable truth of anything in the world?
Yeah, well, that's epistemology, though, right? Mm-hmm. So how can you be sure of the unshakable truth of anything in the world? I mean, a lot of people think that you really can't be absolutely certain about anything.
So you're talking about if your beliefs correlate to the beliefs of the majority, then it must be true.
Oh, no, that's a totally different thing, too.
But isn't that what believing, having an unshakable truth, having something that correlates? So you go, all right, the moon is 250,000 miles from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is that right?
Well,
300,000.
It's getting a little bit further away, isn't it?
Well, it is, actually.
Yeah, all the time, by a little tiny bit.
It is, yeah.
Getting smaller and smaller. But that, apparently, that is so, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so that becomes the accepted belief.
Yeah.
So you're going, all right, so that's so your belief that is true must make it true. And actually, it doesn't. It just means that we agree with the scientists.
Well, okay, yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, do you think anybody really seriously thinks that that believing...
The moon is 25 feet away.
No. Do you think anybody actually seriously believes that to believe what other people around them believe or makes it true?
I think... Well...
Do you think anybody seriously believes that?
I think a lot of people do.
Really?
I'm not saying that I do, and I don't really want to pull this off but having said that, having talked about that, it suddenly occurred to me, having talked about belief, because lots of people do go along with what is true. I mean, that is how horrors happen, isn't it? That's how, you know, all terrible things happen, because a lot of people start to say it's true, and that's kind of what Trump's...
Look at conspiracy theories.
Yes.
How prevalent they are now.
Yeah. Mm. It's like, that. You know, I was working with someone a few years ago in TV, and she was an assistant producer, and we were driving back, and... Well, I happened to talk about the moon landings, which I remember very well as a boy.
Yeah.
I've told you this before. And she goes, oh, you don't believe in all of that rubbish, do you? Right? She was like 25 or something, you know, only a few years ago. I'm sorry.
What do you mean all that rubbish?
Yeah, really. What do you mean all that rubbish? Nobody ever landed on the moon. It's all been proved to be, you know, because this documentary come out and was speaking to another generation who hadn't got any memory of it, and they believed the documentary. They believe that shadows don't converge when they actually do. But I was going to But, you know, it just really makes me furious, being a child of the space age. It makes me furious that people think that.
Mankind's greatest achievement.
Yeah.
And they'd rather believe a YouTube documentary.
But enough people. It's like this terrible thing that's been happening on Google, this Holocaust denial thing that was going on. Where if you type in the Holocaust was, the first thing you got coming up was the Holocaust was or never happened. It was a fake, which was terrible. But it's because there's all these people have bought into this idea that the Holocaust never happened. But of course it did, and that is the truth, and an unshakable truth as far as I'm concerned. But a lot of people believe that. And so this is the thing that Trump's playing with. I think you tell a lie three times, people start to believe it. And enough, and then you kind of, it snowballs, and then the truth is yours. He's trying to appropriate the truth by coming out with all this absolute...
It clouds it all.
Yeah, it clouds what the truth is.
Certainly clouds the truth, but I think we use the truth kind of loosely sometimes, especially when we talk about things like that, right?
Yeah.
We use the word truth loosely. You say that it becomes the truth. What you really mean is that people really start to believe it.
Yes.
It becomes the accepted truth.
It becomes
the
accepted truth.
Which doesn't make it true, right?
No, it doesn't.
Okay. So then if people merely believing something doesn't make it true, what does make it true?
Yeah.
What does make it
true? And how can you know?
Yeah, but one thing at a time, right? One thing at a time, if possible. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's really hard to extricate these questions of epistemology from questions of metaphysics and ontology, right? So questions of epistemology are, how can we know the real truth? And then a question of metaphysics is, what is the real truth, right? And what does it mean for something to be true?
Mm.
But then there are some philosophers who will say, well, look, if we think that there's something out there that makes things really true, but we never have any way of knowing them and have no direct experience of them, then what does it really matter whether they're out there or not? And then a philosopher might also even say, since what we normally think of as knowledge and truth is really just founded on what we're aware of, then that's all that knowledge and truth really are.
Yeah.
It's just... they're just our ideas. So there's okay. So in the theory of truth, right?
Yes.
Among the theories of what truth is for philosophers, there are four basic theories, right?
Ooh, okay.
So you've got the correspondence theory, which is pretty much your common sense. Like, we have our words or propositions or beliefs, and they correspond in some special way to facts or how the world is.
Okay.
There's some kind of magic relationship between, say, the words and the things in the world, which we call the relationship of truth, right?
Okay.
The things in the world make the words truth.
Let's have an EG on that.
That's kind of your an EG.
Yeah.
An EG. Okay. So
fire burns you.
Right. Okay. Fire burns you. Okay. So if I believe that fire burns me, let's see, how can we put this? I mean, actually, it's hard to express a correspondence theory without sounding very trivial. So there's this one way of saying it is, fire burns you is true if and only if fire burns you.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's, if the world is such that it matches the description you've given, then the description is true.
Right, okay.
All right. Very common sense, right?
Yeah,
or
that's,
so it would
that's
seem.
A common sense thing.
The details get pretty hairy because, you know, of arguments about what are the truth bearers and are there such things as facts? And so on.
Okay.
Okay, but first you've got the correspondence theory. Now, the other classical theory is the coherence theory.
Okay.
And the coherence theory is the theory that what makes something true is fitting cohesively into a larger belief system.
Right.
Right. So, in other words, on the basis of a coherence theory, it's not true that the Earth is round just because there's this physical ball out there that, you know, we live on, or out there, I should say, you know, that we live on.
Yeah.
But rather, the Earth is round is true because that statement or that belief fits into our larger system of beliefs.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the coherence theory.
Right. Okay.
What else we got? Then there's the pragmatic theory. The pragmatic theory says that, or a classic statement of it is, truth is the end of inquiry, which means that truth is the beliefs. Truth is consists in the beliefs that we approach as we continue to investigate and learn. Right. So okay. It's, or another way of putting it is, truth is ultimately what it's convenient to believe.
Okay.
Right. And that's not as crazy as it sounds, because it's actually very inconvenient to believe that there's no such thing as gravity. You know, say if you're on top of a building, you'll find it very inconvenient to believe the wrong laws of physics. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, so that's called the pragmatic theory.
Yeah, if you were falling, it'd be very convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you were
falling to the ground, it'd be convenient to believe in the lack of gravity, wouldn't it?
I suppose it would, actually, because then at least you wouldn't be so falling. Frightened.
But then, yeah, exactly. But you would be falling, and then you would go, oh, this is really inconvenient. I'm going to hit the ground. I better believe that gravity doesn't exist.
And then you just stop.
And then you just stop. And yeah.
Well, let's put it another way, right? Suppose you've got sort of a rickety bridge over a canyon, right?
Okay.
So if that bridge is too weak to hold you, right?
Yeah.
Then it's very inconvenient for you to believe that it's strong enough to hold you. Because what you're going to do is walk across the bridge and fall.
Yes. Right.
On the other hand, if you're actually falling,
yeah,
it's convenient to believe that there's no such thing as gravity,
yeah,
because then at least it gives you some hope.
Yeah.
You might not be so afraid.
Yeah. There's just time to think that as you plummet into the ravine. Yeah. What's that theory?
That's sort of a brutally mangled version of the pragmatic theory.
The pragmatic
theory. Right, so associated with the American pragmatists of, you know, the late 19th century William James, Charles Sanders Peirce, people like that.
All right. Okay. We'll have to talk about those pragmatists.
Pragmatists. Well, you know, I don't know. I like I like pragmatism with a small p. Like, to be pragmatic is a good thing. And I like to be pragmatic about philosophy.
Yeah.
But they believe that meaning consists in usefulness and truth consists in usefulness.
Oh.
And I think that's all going a bit too far.
Right, okay.
And then the last of the top four theories.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well,
we've got a countdown.
Yeah.
The last of the top four
coming in at number one.
is the so called deflationary theory of truth.
Oh.
Right? So remember that the way I sort of stated the correspondence theory a few minutes ago, I said, you know, like, fire burns you is true if and only if fire burns you.
Yes.
Right? So, or to take another famous example, snow is white is true if and only if snow is white.
Yes.
Okay? So, the deflationary theorists say that, look, is true doesn't add anything to that at all. To say snow is white and to say snow is white is true are the same thing.
Yeah.
So, actually, truth doesn't really mean anything. It's just this sort of useless expression that we have that doesn't add anything to what we're saying.
Mm. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, I think about truth, you know, the word truth crops up a lot when you're rehearsing actors or you're working on a scene. You know, you're going to go for the truth of a scene. You know?
The truth of the scene.
But it's only in what you are looking at is a representation of truth, a convincing representation of reality, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what I, in the times when I use truth, that's when it crops up. You're kind of holding up, as it were, a mirror up to nature, you know, to quote Polonius.
Well, and according to the correspondence theory, that's what truth always is. It's a representation.
Yeah.
And it's a true representation if what it represents is how the world really is.
Yeah, it corresponds to our understanding, of the world.
So for actors trying to get at the truth of a scene, does that mean that they're trying to find some truth about life that's expressed in the scene and trying to get at that?
Yeah, they're trying to convince. Yeah, they're trying to draw you into a convincing picture of. I mean, this particularly with sort of that's naturalism, isn't it? So within a naturalistic setting, which is film, it tends to be supernaturalistic. And it needs to be an unquestionable, you don't need to question at any time that this person isn't that person that they're pretending to be, you know, feeling the things that they're pretending to feel and, you know, doing what they're pretending to do. So you need an authentic experience as a viewer and as a performer.
Oh, okay.
So that's my, you know, that's where the truth comes in on a practical level for me. And obviously, just but that's whenever I think of truth, that crops up a lot in rehearsals, obviously, because it's a conversation.
And I remember at university doing English, doing romantics.
Yeah.
Keats saying, "What is it? Beauty is truth, and truth is beauty, and that is all there is."
Yeah, to know. Yeah. And
what does that even mean? I've never understood that.
It sounds good.
It's poetic, isn't it? Oh, it's poetic.
It's the romantics, isn't it?
Yeah, you say it to a girl, don't you?
Beauty is truth. Truth, beauty. That is all you need to know. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. I mean, yeah, I go, you know, it's just the pure, you know, the joy of the aesthetic experience is the truest experience you'll ever get, which is a bit shallow, really, if you think about it. But it sounds nice.
Yeah.
It sounds more fun than the pragmatist approach, which just sounds like a killjoy sort of thing of, if it's not true, then it's non-functional, and you couldn't have a joke in a pragmatist book, could you?
Well, yeah. I don't know. Jokes are a kind of use, a kind of convenience.
I'd love to see a pragmatist stand-up. That sounds... That'd be an interesting one. I've just flown in from... You know, instead of going, I've just flown in from Chicago, and boy, am I arm tired. It'd be like, I've just flown in from Chicago on a Boeing 747. I've landed at 7:15, and I've got a cab here to the theatre. Thank you very much.
And boy, was the at the carousel a long...
A really long time I was waiting there.
Not at all convenient.
Let me tell you. But yeah, so maybe that's all I'd like to see. Yeah,
hey, my dog has no nose. How does it smell? Well, it just doesn't, you know.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's
pragmatist comedy, yeah.
Pragmatist comedy. Yeah, I think it's time. It's probably time in this time of this whole kind of... This is the thing. I mean, the reason we're discussing this is because truth is being severely challenged by you-know-who. And it's bizarre because he's taking on the institutions we've been relying on. Or, I mean, the thing about this as well, you know, as a filmmaker, you know... You can make things appear however you like, to be honest. If you have a little, say I made a, you know, I make a political film about a small march. If I want to make it more exciting, I can add, you know, the way I film it, I can present it as though there were more people there, things like that. So you can distort the truth, but we tend to rely on the media for an accurate representation, as far as we know, of what's going on in the world.
They know more than we do anyway.
Yeah. If somebody says Aleppo is bombed and rebels are being forced into the northern sector, we go, well, I've got no reason to doubt that.
Mm-hmm.
And from the pictures, I believe you. So yeah. we've come to rely on the media. And now that whole media is under attack by a group of people of a cabal in the most powerful country in the world trying to actually... stop people believing in flows of information and to start imposing their own flow of information on the world.
Yeah. So Trump is really trying to circumvent the whole thing. And actually, this is funny because you've heard this expression, post-truth, right?
Mm.
So, right, people say that we're in this post-truth world, and we can talk more about what that means. But the term comes from this book from 2004 by this guy called, Ralph Keyes, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's a book in 2004. And I haven't read much of it, but we can talk a little about what he means. But I was surprised to see that back in 2004, who was one of his prime examples of a post-truthist, right? He says, I'll just read this little passage, okay? When Trump, The Art of the Deal, was published, Donald Trump claimed that 200,000 copies had been printed, that the Today Show planned to interview him 5 times, and that the issue of New York Magazine with an excerpt of his book was the biggest selling ever. In fact, 150,000 copies of Trump were printed. Today interviewed him twice, and New York sales figures were not available at the time that he made his claims.
Mm.
In his book, Trump called this kind of braggadocio truthful hyperbole.
Mm.
Truthful, I guess, is ironic in this case. Yeah. Truthful hyperbole, he calls it. After The Apprentice became a hit, his TV show, Trump claimed his television show was the season's ratings leader, when it was actually number 7, and said he was America's highest paid television personality. A Fortune magazine reporter who debunked these claims and many others concluded that Trump's boasts about himself were at best loosely truth based.
loosely truth based.
Based
Trump.
On a true story.
yeah. That's right. Inspired by true events.
But this is one of the things that Keyes points out as indicative of this post truth era that he thinks we're in, right? So, which is that we have loads and loads of these euphemisms for false and lying, right? Mm. So, what was it? Truthful hyperbole, as Donald Trump himself put it, and loosely truth based. He's got a whole list of them here: poetic truth, parallel truth, nuanced truth. Don't forget spin, non-full disclosure, selective disclosure, augmented reality.
Oh my God!
And of course, nowadays we have our new favorite: alternative facts.
Yeah. Alt facts, alternative facts. Yeah, that's awful. What's her name? Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah. Kellyanne Conway. Yeah.
But it used to be. You used to get this sense. You know, everyone goes, "Oh, I don't trust politicians and all that."
Yeah.
But when politicians were blatantly caught out lying, there used to be a sense that they had to kind of backpedal and apologise.
Yeah.
But now what they do is they just kind of push it further.
Yeah.
Double down.
Yeah, double down.
Yeah, it's true, and it's interesting that this book was published in 2004. Mm-hmm. So that was the George W. Bush era, and to my mind, Bush and his group were really pioneers of this sort of post-truth technique, because they would say something false in a news conference, and there would be a whole lot of hubbub about it, and then the next day they would retract it or correct it. Mm. But the retractions and corrections don't make much news.
No.
So
it's the initial statements.
I think we said this before. So, you know, once the lie is out there, it takes on its own life.
Yeah.
And so it's a very powerful technique to just lie and then retract it later, but nobody cares about the retraction. But nowadays, like Jay says, they're not even doing that. They're just doubling down.
Well, that's, I know, and it's grim. Quite openly doubling down, and you know that makes you start to go well, but it does what it does is it disrupts your compass. It sends your compass spinning, so you stop being able to instinctively believe in certain channels of information. Over time, that is what happens. It's like, because I think Trump in the Art of the Deal has got a phrase in there. I've read somewhere.
Really?
You tell a lie three times.
Oh, yes. Okay. That comes from there.
It starts to become true. And he does that a lot. He uses repetition a lot. He'll say whatever he feels like, and he'll say it a number of times, and he'll say it again. Great. And he'll say it again.
And we elected this man.
Well, you didn't. Man. None of us here did. You know, people did. A certain number of people did. But yeah, that's terrible. But it starts to mess with your radar, with your antenna,
or your rudder, yeah.
And over time, it wears it down. And I think that's what it is. It's a war of attrition, really, on the media, on the perceived truth, and that's very concerning. And it is very, you have to, and also, I mean, the thing is, it's made easier with this, with the internet, with this flow of information.
I think that the internet is as responsible for a lot of like conspiracy theory, the proliferance of conspiracy theories. Because it used to be that if you believed something like there were Nazis on the far side of the moon, some people do. You would be a kind of lone person in, I don't know, Norwich, and you might make a small leaflet that you posted on some wall of some cafe. But now what you can do is you can form a group, and then somebody else over the other side of the world will say, no, I believe that too. And then suddenly so you're not like a crazy lone person anymore.
No.
You can connect with people and then people start to feel like included, because they're kind of, you know, they're kind of forming a group of outcasts.
Mm.
And maybe that's part of why there's so much more now, so many more conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and there are lots of ways that the internet makes deceit more common. And this is, again, one of the things that Keyes talks about, which is that basically that our network of people that we're sort of loosely acquainted with has grown so much that we have more freedom and more temptation to sort of enhance our own stories and be more of who we'd like to be as we're presented on the internet, for example, rather than who we're not. And of course, we remember early on when You know, it was when we didn't have Facebook and things like that, but it was just sort of like chat rooms and bulletin boards and things. And you remember all that stuff. Yeah. And of course, always there'd be people on there are always pretending to be someone that they're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the internet does tend to feed this, I think, this tendency to be untruthful.
And this tendency to dress up the truth, to base, you know, to base things on truth. You know, you self-publish a book, great. You sell a few copies, you're an author, you start to, you know, people manifest themselves as more successful authors than they are, perhaps, or whatever. I don't know.
At what point does an exaggeration become?
Yeah, this hyperbole. What was it called?
Truthful hyperbole.
There's a lot of it about.
But there's also this entirely new thing. I think it's entirely new. I think it's not just a difference of degree, but a difference of kind, right?
Mm.
Which is this fake news that you get on the internet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there are people, there are websites that literally do hardly anything but publish news stories that aren't funny or insightful, but just false. And it's all just about clickbait, right?
They're targeted.
Yeah.
Completely, you know, so it could be a teenager in Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
Completely writing some article that he thinks a group of people in Alabama will think, gee, this is exactly what we think.
Yeah, and of course, brilliantly, Trump turns around this idea of fake news and uses it against the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, etc. It reminds me of
Spinal Tap, the bit where they're in the corridor and they go, it's just that little twist between clever and stupid.
Yeah.
It's just like Trump. It's just that little twist between like truth and fiction, you know.
Mm. But now here's one of the interesting things that Sean Spicer and Kellyanne Conway were saying, which is that when they talk about things like alternative facts, they're partly relying on the belief that we can't know. Like what they said about the crowd sizes for Trump's inauguration, for the Women's March, things like that.
Yeah.
We can't know. There's no way to calculate accurate crowd sizes. So you have your numbers and I have mine.
Yeah.
And while I don't think that they're metaphysically denying that there's a correct number of people that attended these events, they're saying that we can never know that, and therefore, you know, everyone's sort of free to give their own wonky estimates, however poor they may be.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So in a way, then the philosopher's skepticism kind of creeps in there as a justification for this notion of alternative facts and we'll never get at the truth. So the best truth we can have is just your truth, my truth. Trump's got his truth. Mm. New York Times has got their own truth.
Mm. And who, you know, who can we start to, and then we have to gravitate. I mean, we all gravitate to what we've all got, political bias, you know, to various degrees. We gravitate towards information that, you know, we were talking about this before, you know, that serves our reality tunnel or fits in with our perception of things. I mean, we tend to do that. I think what happens on a certain level is that you start to become much more wary of everything. I mean, I think that's been creeping in to the way I view information now. I'm a lot less accepting, because, you know, if even on a simple level where you've seen something interesting, you know, on the web or something, you go, oh, that's great, oh, share that, like blah blah blah. Yeah. And then you realize, oh, it was something that happened 5 years ago. Was it? Oh, I didn't notice the thing. Oh, and it's not true. And you go, oh god, now I feel a right idiot. And somebody points it out, which is good.
Yeah,
which is good. But because you start
Snopes
to get,
is just about my favorite organization in the whole world right now.
Like, who's what? That?
Snopes.
Fact-checking website.
It's been good for years.
They bust all the myths.
I've been using it for years.
And of course, they're accused of being partisan and, you know, more fake news and blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah, exactly.
This is ridiculous. As far as, I mean, anything I've ever seen that they publish, they're really just doing their best to get down at the nuanced truth of the matter.
Mm.
And often the answer isn't, it's true, it's false, it's, there are these parts that are true, there are these parts that are exaggerated, there are these parts that are just plain false.
Yeah.
And that's how the world really is. That's the reality of it. Mm. It's probably true of most news articles.
We need our, you know, we need people, we need our guardians of truth. And it sounds like Snopes are doing, you know, as good a job as... Because everything's open to the human error and the fact... I mean, actually, it's a great skill to be able to be incredibly unbiased and to see things as clearly as possible and to try and pronounce them as clearly as possible. I mean, that is a fantastic skill to have. And we need that more than ever when we've got such wide-ranging... I mean, I think we were talking about this the other week, weren't we, about the polarisation of things, you know. Belief systems are getting extremely polarized.
Yes.
And here we go again, right back to what you were saying earlier about belief and truth.
Yeah.
And the power of belief over truth, really. Because belief can knock truth out and has done historically for millennia.
Yeah. But as Neil deGrasse Tyson says, just because you believe something doesn't make it
true. Yeah. Mm. Exactly.
Well, okay. Now, all of that is sort of predicated on our faith that what's true is true, what's false is false. Doesn't matter what you believe. Doesn't matter what your conceptual scheme is. Doesn't matter what your belief system is.
There is a truth.
There's just facts that are what they are. They're ineffable. And then there's our beliefs, which are usually wrong.
Right.
But, okay, so one of the ideas behind the coherence theory is that we don't actually have access to an external world. So everything that we see are just sort of images in our minds. Uh-huh. We don't even know exactly how our sort of immediate experiences are connected with the physical world.
Right.
And there's also an argument that the only justification for a belief is another belief. So if that's right, then all we really have are beliefs. Mm. And what can truth consist in then except fitting into some kind of a system of beliefs?
Mm.
Right? So we'd like to believe that there's an objective world out there, but okay. Many philosophers have argued that even if there is, we have no access to it. Right? So go back to Bishop Berkeley, for example, right?
Yeah.
So you see a tree out there in the field. We call it a tree, and according to Berkeley, what we're referring to when we say tree is our impression of a tree that's out there, because that's all we've got.
Yeah,
we can't ever know the real nature of the tree. We can't ever, you know, we have these images of it, which presumably don't at all in any way resemble the tree itself or the thing in itself. Right? Kant had a very similar view. Though he didn't deny that there's an independent reality altogether, his view is that so many important things about the way we perceive the world are determined by our own sort of forms of understanding by the categories, right? So space and time, space and time are things that happen in our own minds. They're not part of the real world. And the things that happen in our minds don't resemble what happens in the world. Okay, so if we're convinced by these sorts of skeptical arguments, then what can truth be except just fitting into a system of beliefs? And then if we accept that, if we like that sort of a coherence theory of truth, then we can see different cultures and different groups that have different systems of belief. And then we're left in this situation where we have no baseline against which to adjudicate, you know, who's right and who's wrong.
Oh, I should just interject doing the social media thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's our first kind of shout out that we've ever done.
Oh.
Yeah, because Emma Louise Barkham just said, "Hey, you guys."
Oh.
Hey.
Hey, Emma Louise Barkham.
Hey, Emma.
There
we go.
Hey. Shout out.
Shout out.
Shout out.
If that's your real name.
Yeah.
I believe it is.
Okay. Yeah.
But you never know with those bar clams.
No. I mean, that Vicky.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Emma's just as bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah.
Well, talking about John Betjeman's got a quote like that. Says, "We understand about as much of reality as a cod swimming 5 miles off Grimsby has got the concept of what's going on in the town centre."
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So, but then
we are cod. Yeah. We are cod swimming in the North Sea of reality.
So, we are cod. Good name for a band.
Yeah.
So we think we know all this stuff, right? We think we know the world is round. We think we know that global warming is real.
Yeah. And look, Dixons have got a sail on. Yeah.
And I believe it, and I think it's very important that we should be doing everything we can to slow global warming.
Yes.
But think for a minute about why you believe that's real. Mm. For myself, I can say that I have read about zero of the actual science on global warming.
Yeah.
Even if I had read it, I would be trusting what the scientists had written.
Mm-hmm.
And what I believe is that there's a scientific consensus.
Yeah.
That is based on a lot of good evidence
yeah.
that this is really happening and it's really caused by man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to lend any support to those who deny it and think that we should just keep, you know, helping the petroleum business and forget about it.
Yeah.
But if I'm serious about it, the only reason I believe in global warming is because I trust the people who tell me
yeah.
that people I trust have good reason to believe
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And why do you trust them?
I don't know. I'm not sure why.
Mm.
I think one of the reasons is that I think that it's much more plausible that scientists who have to be somewhat accountable for their work are more interested in getting at the truth than the business and politics connected people.
Because they have less of an agenda.
Yeah.
That isn't profit-based.
That's right.
Yeah, because I'm very much of the, you know, the big corporations are evil and will do everything they can for a buck and say whatever they want that suits them. That's my personal belief. And also, yeah, I tend to trust the scientists. I will look at, for example, you know, the Twin Towers conspiracy theory. Never has been a paper presented in science, you know, in Nature, you know, which is a huge scientific thing, or in the New Scientist. No one has come forward with a serious paper, although loads of people have claims of otherwise.
People say things like, oh, if a plane flew into a skyscraper, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I said, well, what other plane flying into a skyscraper have you got to test that theory against?
Yeah.
You know, it's only happened once.
Yeah.
You know,
well, twice on the same day.
On the same thing, and the same thing yeah. happened. So that's kind of scientific, yeah. you know. It's repeatable, evidence.
So, but of course, I tend to think, oh well, if that's not the case, then it certainly can't be the case. I mean, I'm complete with Noam Chomsky on all his theories about why it's just completely illogical, blah blah blah. That would have ever happened. But there are people who place as much faith as I would in what an article in the New Science, or, you know, Nature or New Scientist. They believe that the Bible is full of truth. And
I'm sure it is. There's a lot of stuff in the Bible. But
yeah, something in there must be true.
Yeah.
He went outside. What's
some place names.
Yeah, lots of place names, yeah. things like that. But, I mean, so, it is. We trust certain, you trust certain sources.
You know what? There's more to it than that, though. It's not just the sources, because, you know, there's a thing that you can do. Do you remember geometry class? Right? And so you have these geometric diagrams, and they're not meant to exactly represent the figures that you're doing a proof about, but certain things about them are correct, right?
Right.
Like the number of intersections between lines. And sort of not the exact angles, but, you know, the relative sizes of some of the angles.
Yeah.
And we have a way of...
I don't remember geometry as vividly as you, but carry on.
I don't think we did geometry.
No.
No.
It was a rubbish skill.
That's too bad. That's too bad. There's a lot to learn about.
We missed out.
To learn about sort of epistemology.
Through geometry.
Yeah.
Just quickly. Hello, Mum.
Oh!
Hey.
Hello, Jason's Mum. Hello, Christine.
Hey, Jason's Mum.
Yeah, nice to drop in.
But there are ways that we can sort of that we can sort of smell out the truth about things, right?
Yeah.
So with geometric diagrams, you know, there are ways to sort of see what's important about them, even though we know they're not completely accurate. And I think that's a sense that we use a lot when we're reading the media, when we're reading philosophical papers, for example, like, you know, or or when I read, for example, I read about a topic in mathematics on Wikipedia. Why do I trust Wikipedia? Any idiot could write something up there. Mm. But when I read what's written, I have a sense about its truth by the way it's written, by the detail, by the references, and just by the content, right? Mm. I find the content itself convincing.
Because you, but also as an academic, you've trained yourself to look for clues. You know, you're thin slicing, aren't you? You're making instinctive judgments on the quality of what you're reading, and deciding whether or not to go along with that particular idea.
Yeah.
Because you've been trained to do that. You've trained yourself to do that. You've read lots of papers. You've written lots of papers, and so that's fair enough. But that's also, I mean, ultimately, you know, it does tie back to what we were saying about Robert Anton Wilson in a way. The other day, you know, you are buying into that. You've decided that that makes sense to you, and you, there are a number of people who agree with you, and you will be able to disagree on the particular truth of something, of a paper that you've read, but you'll all be using a common language and a common understanding about that's come about and what it stands for.
Yeah, it's kind of troubling to me to think about this, because even though I believe that there's such a thing as objective truth, and I think that something like a correspondence theory is closer to the right way to think about truth, when I actually do epistemology, when I actually think about, when I try to judge what's true and what's not, I use more of a coherence kind of criterion, right?
Right.
How well does what I'm reading fit into what I already know and believe? How does it sort of, does it pass the smell test?
Mm. Yeah. And as a philosopher, really, I mean, I get the feeling that, you know, philosophy is at a time where, especially we're talking about truth, it's very fundamental to have a way of staying open and coming up with some fundamental, but you've got to have like a rack of fundamental truths that you know you can't rattle all of them at once, but somebody should come along and be able to rattle that particular belief, that exoplanets are capable of sustaining life. You know, we have a belief about that, because they're like the Earth. Da, 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 da. But if someone came along and rattled
very
that
topical.
And you go, well, actually, yeah, exactly. We say, you go, well, actually, now the Earth, I think, is capable of sustaining life because of its relationship with the sun and the moon, which happen to balance each other out. And so what we've got is a moon that's 250,000 miles away, 300,000 miles away, and a sun that is a certain number of times bigger, but also further away. So actually they match up and balance.
That's why you get an eclipse.
That's why you get an eclipse. And maybe that's why life, you know, and somebody comes up with, you know, and somebody comes up with a theory about that. And it's nothing to do with water or distance from the sun, temperature, something like that. But I've got, you know, I can believe quite solidly that it's that the physical criteria are important. But there might other be esoteric criteria that are as fundamental to life as the presence of oxygen and hydrogen, for example.
Yeah, I think about things like that, that you have to say. Also, that, you know, there might be a ferret in my refrigerator.
Yeah.
But I don't have any good reason to think so.
About, not belief or truth, but speculation.
That's speculation, yeah.
Yeah.
Because until we can actually find some evidence, we just don't know.
No, we don't.
So we can't say, oh, it's true that there might be life, or it's false. We can only speculate that maybe it's common because the universe is so vast, and there are, turns out there are lots of planets similar to Earth around other star systems. But we can't actually say.
I mean, I'm assuming, and I don't know, that scientists have been able to put a whole load of chemicals together and rattle them about in a soup and make something that create something.
I remember actually they covered this on Cosmos like back in the 80s. They've been able to make some kind of like an amino acid soup by like electrifying certain simpler chemicals in a.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know.
So I'm assuming that you can do that.
Yeah, it might be an experiment that needs a few billion years to sort of.
You can get enough of a spark out of nothing, or, you know, the right amount of soup. To make you think, oh yes, well, exoplanets, they are quite capable of.
Slight tangent though.
Yes.
Corey Bolus says, aloha.
Corey.
Yeah.
Hey Corey.
And he says, it appears to be about the truth in the news and the like. is more about ideological subversion. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, ideological subversion. Now, I wonder what...
What do you mean by that, Corey?
What do you mean, Corey? Ideological subversion.
Tell us what you mean by ideological subversion.
So, ideologically motivated, I think that's what he means. Like, ideologically motivated subversion.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah. So,
so you're faking something. The Bowling Green Massacre.
Yeah.
It's a fake thing.
Do you think
thing
that was intentional?
Try and make a point.
Do you think that was intentional BS or was it just...
No, I think she's just the stream of whatever... You know, comes out.
You know what that is actually, right? So we've been talking about truth. We've been talking about falsity. There are truth, lies, damn lies, statistics.
And there's Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah. And that's, which, you know, so like that fits in this category of bullshit.
Oh, bullshit.
Right? So this is really, there's this really interesting little book by Harry Frankfurt. Who's a very important moral philosopher. Oh. But his publisher had this fantastic idea of taking one of his sort of longer essays about bullshit and putting in a little book and putting it next to next to tellers at bookshops.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, listen, there's this.
Sold a number of those. Yeah. But it's a very interesting little book. It's sort of like an introspective conceptual analysis of what bullshit is that makes it different from other kinds of untruth.
Let's talk bullshit.
So,
have you got a quote? Is there anything in
there? I don't have a nice quote or anything, but... But his what bullshit is for him, that's just it.
Just open it, pretend.
Basically, what he comes to in the end is that what makes bullshit different from lies is that bullshit. Well, actually, he makes an interesting point about the word shit, right? Because a shit is never carefully crafted.
Well, speak for yourself.
It
just comes out.
It just comes out. And it may be more or less coherent, or it may not. But it's something that's done with a complete disregard for the truth. So whether you're a politician, whether you're just talking crap at a party, or whether you're in advertising, where the bullshit is carefully crafted, but it's crafted without a regard for truthfulness.
Just had a Facebook question, which actually directly relates in a way to what you've just been saying.
Okay.
Charlie Cowan says, do arseholes know that arseholes?
Apparently not. I guess there was some
research. Are arseholes self-aware?
There was actually some research very recently that showed that people who think they're very smart are often very stupid and too stupid to know that they're stupid.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember the details of this research, but I think we've been seeing a lot of that in the world recently.
Yes, I don't know, but we've all been guilty at some point.
I don't know who said it, but it says, when you're dead, you don't know you're dead, but it's difficult for others. It's the same when you're stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
I just opened this up here on bullshit, and there's a quote here. There is a distinction between a person who tells a lie and a liar. The former is one who tells a lie unwillingly, while the liar loves to lie and passes his time in the joy of lying. The latter takes delight in lying, rejoicing in the falsehood itself. That's by Ibid.
That's
a quote. That's a quote within the bullshit book. So just to show that, there are elements of truthfulness within the bullshit book, even, you know. I think the whole thing should... It sounds like it's too honest.
The whole thing should be bullshit. Book.
You should get to the end and go, That was just
crap.
But that, look, there we go. We're recommending On Bullshit by Harry G. Frankfurt. Don't say we never share anything with you.
Yeah, we'll get commission.
Yeah. By the way, are we enjoying the wine?
It's lovely.
It's nice,
very
isn't
nice,
it?
Very nice.
I'll just a little plug for that again in case anybody fancies...
We need sponsorship.
We do. Viñedos Barrijuelo.
Well, you know, the Sainsbury family actually has a philosopher. There's a Mark Sainsbury who's... I know he's written a nice textbook on philosophical logic.
Oh, he'd bring some good wine, wouldn't he?
Yeah, right?
We should get him on.
Yeah, we should ring him up.
Yeah.
Are we anywhere? Oof.
Too. I tell you what. Well, let's just have a little spot.
How many people seek the truth in a bottle of wine or a glass of whiskey?
Where does that expression come from? In vino veritas. That means... If you've drunk enough wine, something will slip out.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, you know, there's no hiding behind wine, really, is there? Things do come out.
I'm sure there are ways to hide.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. I mean,
you can always say, it was the wine talking. This is what we'll say tomorrow about this episode.
Yeah, it was the wine talking. But it's been very nice wine. I mean, I don't know. Where are we? We're very close to the end, and it feels like we're reaching a natural halt to our bullshit and our truth and our lies.
Is there some summation of a philosophical way?
If only we were that skilled. What we could come up with a good conclusion for next time, yeah, at the beginning. Maybe we should do the conclusion of each previous episode at the beginning of the next one.
Yeah.
When we've had some time to think about it.
In a sober state.
Well, can I have a eureka moment at the start of each episode?
Well, what I've thought of is that truth is very important to a philosopher and vice, and philosophy is very important to truth.
But truth is very important to all of us, and I think this is becoming clearer and clearer right now, even though that... We seem to be in a state of the world in which truth is less and less valued, and perceptions and persuasion are more and more important. Right?
Mm.
Who cares if it's true? Just throw it out there; they'll eat it up.
Mm.
But truth is important because, and this is something that the pragmatists had right, because if you get it wrong, it's going to come back and bite you in the ass.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much the important point, isn't it?
Yeah. Don't let it bite you in the ass. Stay true. Stay true to yourself.
Stay true to your ass.
Yeah. And to your own self be true. You know, that's...
To your own ass be true.
Yeah, to your own ass. Here's to that. Cheers.
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 We need to play out.
Oh, of course.
Hold your horses there, Gav.
Hold your horses.
Oh, he's ready to go home.
Got some music here.
2, 3.